Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Anatomy of Movie as we talk Lights Out today, and we have a special guest. Stay tuned, and we'll find out who.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Anatomy of a Movie.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen, we're talking horror today with Lights Out. We have Marissa Serafini.
Hello, everyone.
And as teased, we have Alex DePersia, a.k.a. Brett, from the movie!
Brett, Brad, Brent,
whatever. One of those ones.
Listen, I kept thinking that your name was Brad in the entire movie.
Yeah, I mean, I thought my name was Brad for half the movie.
Was it written Brett in the script?
It was written Brett with one T.
One T.
Yeah.
I don't know most Bretts with two T's, though.
I thought it was a two-T name.
I thought it was a two-T name.
No.
The Mr. Spelling over here.
Why do you need to?
Mr. Name Pronunciating.
Anyway, welcome to the show. Thank you for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
I got to first and foremost applaud the movie. I thought it was amazing.
Thank you.
And you know what? We don't have Dimitri Panos today, who is a horror buff, nor Daryl Kristen. They're off on vacation. So I dragged Marissa into this.
Yes.
Not a horror buff.
Not a horror.
But I've did enjoy it.
I did, you know, because I'm one for, like, a good drama story, and this film, for a horror, had a good drama story, and I was thoroughly surprised.
For sure.
You take the horror out, it's just a really good dramatic story, family elements, and then, you know, you're rooting for these people. It's a mini family, but, you know, you want to see good at the end of the film.
Yeah, I think we owe a success to that story. I mean, it's not just a run-of-the-mill horror film. It's more than what you expect when you go in, I think.
So let me ask you this. Did you, you know, during the audition process or whatnot, did you go and see the short film?
I saw the short, I think, before my last meeting on the film. You know, I'd read the script. Obviously, a very appealing script because of the family element that you mentioned. It's more than just like a campy horror film. It's not just a bunch of pretty people getting murdered somewhere. There's a lot more than that. And then as I got closer and closer to the role, I watched the short just to get the idea of the concept. But, you know, it's an awesome – I don't know if gimmick's kind of underselling it, but simple primal fear trick that we use in the film, but then wrap this wonderful story around it.
Yeah, you know, I didn't see the short film until after this because I found it that it was available just on YouTube or something. And I enjoy it. But, you know, I like the concept. Where was – Can you tell us about the audition process for you and how you got
the involved? Audition process for me was an interesting one. I live in New York, and so we shot this, I believe it would have been last June. Mm-hmm. June is when we shot it. So in like March, I remember I self-taped for this and sent – that's when you tape yourself with mm-hmm. your agency or something and you send it across the country because you're too lazy to get on a plane and fly to Los Angeles. And nothing happened with it. And I totally forgot about the project. And I'd come out to L.A. For a wedding for some friends. My manager sent me the script and they were like, you know, give it a read. See what you think. You know, Teresa Palmer's attached. So I read it and I was like, I've read this script before. And they're like, oh, yeah, but there's new casting directors. And I was like, well, I mean, if they didn't like me the first time, they're not going to like me now. And they're like, just drop it, go for it. And I went in, and it's a casting director I'd known for a really long time since he was an assistant for some other casting directors. And he's like, I love you for this part. So I read for it. Didn't really think much of it. And then, you know, later in the day, my manager's like, they're great. They love you. They love you. You're great. And I was, you know, you hear this stuff all the time. You don't really think. Yeah. I think this was a Thursday and on Friday – or a Wednesday. And on Friday, I was leaving for Napa to go to this wedding. So they call me Thursday and they're like, all right, you're gonna test with Tez on Friday. And I was like, oh, this is great. But we kept moving the times. So finally I test – I forget what time I tested. It went really – it was fun. You know, Teresa's a great actress. The scenes that we shot were not scary scenes. They were the kind of the nice, intimate scenes together. And I'd missed my flight to Napa, so I ended up driving to Napa, which, you know, sometimes people are like, oh, it's like an 8-hour drive, but you're like, oh, they're really exaggerating. It's like a 4-hour drive. It's an 8-hour drive. And I drove to Napa, and as soon as I got there, they called, and they were like, you got the part. And I was like, oh, amazing. Like, how soon can you be here? I was like, not soon at all. I'm in Napa for a wedding. They're like, tomorrow morning? And I was like, no, I literally just drove 8 hours. It's 7 p.m. Cut to... Now 7 p.m. Sunday, 5:30 a.m. Monday, we were working.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's a very short turnaround.
Yeah, very short turnaround.
That's really cool because, you know, reading all those scenes and with your test with Teresa, like, I loved your chemistry. And, in the movie between you two, because, you know, you brought a lot of levity to the movie, like comedic relief more so, yeah. Especially during all the scary moments. Yeah. So I was like, oh, thank God.
It makes them a bit scarier, you know, and I think it gives the audience a break while they're watching it. And, you know, Tez and I spent a lot of time together off set playing. She has a stepson, a son, and a son on the way. So there's like a lot of playfulness and fun going on. And we got to know each other really well, which we were able to bring that on screen, I think, which was nice, you know, and bring that relationship onto the screen. And,
yeah, absolutely. It felt natural. So, like, what I liked about this film, I mean, obviously James Wan's helped produce, you know, this film, big name in the horror genre. Like, how much was he creatively involved?
James was very creatively involved. He was on set a good amount of the time. For David, it was his first. David went from making a short film that he uploaded to YouTube to making a studio film that ended up at Comic-Con, which is crazy, within, I think, a year and a half. James put a lot of trust in him, but James was also on set. I think, you know, James is very good at what he does. He's our generation's, you know, Wes Craven or whatever, whoever you want to call him. He's the king of horror. Not just horror anymore. He's moved on to Fast and Furious. He's doing TV now. He's doing MacGyver. So he was on set a lot for the scares. I think he has a certain way he likes to produce these scares. So he came on set a lot for those. And it helped David. It also, I think, it lent more confidence to David for his kind of directorial debut feature.
Did you get to interact with him much?
Yeah, yeah. He's the most wonderfully sweet and fun and playful guy you've ever met. It's opposite from what you'd expect. There's nothing like dark or horror-y about him. He's positive and smiling and jumping up and down all the time. He's an amazingly wonderful guy to be around. Different than expected.
And how is David, you know, since this was his first time kind of directing? I mean,
David's, very Swedish. Everything is like, he's like unwavering, like just monotonous in a sense. And, you know, you had no idea. Everything was so cool. And, you know, Tez and I would be like, how was that take? He'd be like, yeah, that was really good. We're moving on. I'd be like, what? And then one day Tez had the story that was, like David was standing in the corner kind of like this. And she's like, is everything all right? He's like, I'm a little overwhelmed by all this, you know, all these people. And she was like, this is you being overwhelmed? Like, you know, he's such a calm guy. I think it's, testament to him and his ability to just do this. You know, he showed up on a big set. He'd been to film school. Mm-hmm. He made these shorts with his wife, Lotta, in their apartment in Sweden. This was a huge step. He handled it unbelievably.
Yeah, I mean, the nice part is, I mean, he does have a history. I read more about him. Like, he's been making movies, but, you know, he was not, like, directing them. He was working for other people. So it's always nice to see kind of in that way, because the one thing I hate when people take it, oh, here's a first-time director that just made a short, uploaded it, and now look at him. You know what I mean? Like, he did.
Not the case.
Yeah, he cut his teeth.
Yeah, so it's like, every actor is an overnight success. It's like, we've been doing this a long time, people.
Yeah. Right. I like the fact that, you know, you're working with James Wan, who's already, you know, very experienced in this genre, and then, you know, David, who's not as well for directing and whatnot. But then you're also working with, like, really well-established actors.
We have great actors.
Maria Bello. I was thoroughly surprised Maria Bello. I was like, oh, hey, it's Maria.
Yeah.
Maybe something good will come out of this, because I love her as well. But what's it like, you know, being opposite next to, like, two very strong actresses and just characters in this the movie itself?
It was amazing. You know, I Maria came on later in the process. You know, Tez being attached to the project made it very appealing to me. She's done really well in her career. She's continuing to do well. She's a very talented woman. And then when Maria got attached, I was like, wow, this is really cool. You know, Maria is somebody I've watched since I was a kid. Love everything she does. Mm-hmm. She brings so much weight to characters. And to this character in particular, you know, Maria struggles with manic depression in her own life. So to bring that to this character was a lot, and I'm sure difficult for her to do. But just having those two women to play opposite of was an honor. It was awesome.
Oh, I can imagine. But you also held your own during this.
I did the best that I could. I think the best thing about, you know, like I said, James put his trust into David. David really put his trust into us as actors, which was nice. And Eric Heiser, our screenwriter, wrote an awesome screenplay, and he was also a producer. So he, first day on set, he said, you know, I've hung up my cap as a writer, and now I'm a producer. So we all had this amazing back and forth where we worked on scenes. We broke things down so we could figure out what these characters wanted and where they were going and the best way to get there.
How would you describe your character of Brett? Because I think what I like most about this movie, you have really incredibly strong women, but then, you know, the guys are equally as strong. And in particular, Brett, I mean, they could have written him as just some douchebag boyfriend,
yeah.
But he's really not.
He's unwavering in his love for this woman. He will do anything to be with her. He's earnest. He's straightforward with her in all his opinions. He doesn't hold anything back, and he's there for her. I think it's funny. A lot of times during the junk and a lot of interviews I've done, like, oh, man, world's greatest boyfriend. Like, no guys are like this in real life. I'm like, man, people really have a low opinion of men that like, we're going to run at every, you know, at every chance you get. So this character, I wouldn't say he was a lot like me, but, you know, I don't know. We live in 2016. Things aren't like dating isn't super easy. Things are not that easy.
I think it's more so like a trope of horror to write in like a bad boyfriend.
For sure, bad boyfriend, yeah. who either gets killed right away, makes like the worst decisions. And I think another trope before is you don't really root for any of the characters. And I think the nice thing about this story is you root for every single one of them, whether it's Martin the little kid or Maria to get better. You root for everybody. You want everybody to win. You don't want people to get killed off. You know, when they go in the basement, it's not like, don't go in the basement. Let's see what happens. You're like, oh, man, don't go in the basement. I don't want to see this go the wrong way with you guys. I really care about you.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, because when I first saw your character and how he was established, that bad boy, I'm like, I immediately turned to Phil. I was like, oh, great. He's going to die.
Yeah. Well, the way we look, too, you know, we've got our leather jackets and the hair's long and tatted up, you know.
Exactly. And, you know, a lot of tropes in horror films, like the couple that always sleeps together first is usually the first to die. I was like, oh no, we know where this.
That's
is
why
going.
We picked it up post coitus, so you know sure, we could survive.
But you know, like, but your character did grow on me, especially because like he did seem earnest, and you know he really was sincere and cared about the family and her. And I was like, all right, I can root for this guy.
Thank you.
I mean, to me, the smartest line was, said, you know, are you doing this for him or are you doing it for you?
Yeah,
and that. Confrontation and there's just some comedy to it, like I still don't know who Diane is.
Some of those scenes were, it was funny. Tez and I had like so many headbutting sessions with our director. We're like, are you sure we should put a joke in here? Like, is this really necessary? And he's like, yeah, just do it this one way for us. And we'd like every kind of scene, I feel like I threw a line away, ended up making it into the movie, you know.
Hilarious.
Did you have much freedom to do, like, go off the script?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't – we cleared it with our writer and with our producers. I mean, they were on set the whole time. So we were like, hey, if we want to – you know, we want to change this a little bit in this direction to make the relationship seem a little more authentic, they were totally down for it. It was awesome.
Neat.
Excellent. Let me ask you this. In terms of what's been the thing that you like audiences reacting to in terms of your character? Because, I mean, in terms of your character, right, for me – as I was watching, right, when he kind of gets in the car and you hear the car drive off and poor Barnes, like,
he didn't leave us, did he?
You know, everyone at that point is like, did he?
But you know, it's funny. It's like, I think feel like half the audience is like, this guy's smart. And half of them are like, oh, this guy's the worst. You know, like that's.
Is there a preferred reaction for you?
My preferred reaction is just, you know, I'd seen a bunch of screenings of it over the months, and then we had the premiere, which at the Chinese Theater, which was really exciting. You know, they were like, when he lights the car up, it's the greatest scene in the world, and the theater just went nuts, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And that was really exciting. For me, that's probably my favorite part to watch, just because it's like so WWF. He comes flying down this driveway and just gets clotheslined and destroyed, yeah. And it seems like he's over with, but he's not. So I enjoy watching that. You know, like I said, last night I went to see Bourne, and then I like snuck in to the end of Lights Out to see how people reacted just for fun.
How did they react?
They just go, people just, it's like a hoot and hollering type thing. It's awesome. It's fun.
It's a great reaction. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and speaking to, you know, getting thrown around and whatnot, there's a lot of stunts and wiring in this.
Yeah, I made some bad decisions.
Filming process like?
It was difficult. It was fun. I hadn't done many stunts before, and obviously I had a stuntman, but I did a lot of the stuff on my own, which I will never do again. Not a good idea to do your own stunts or to, like, take a few hits, because it's not like you take a hit once or twice. Like you take it, like, 15 times in a row. you get rigged up and pulled in the air. It happens over and over, and by the I'll never do it again. I'm like, no reason for it. That's what some people are there for, right?
Right.
I read that in terms of the lighting, right, they wanted to have it as natural as they could. Obviously, you still have to have some, you know, lighting and whatnot. But did that also kind of set the tone in terms of, you know, as you guys are shooting it, it's a little bit easier perhaps to get into character?
For sure. We shot in this really well, there was the apartment that there's a few scenes in that Rebecca and I share, or I'm trying to share with her. And then there was the house in Highland Park was where we shot. And that house was so dark the entire time we shot there. And no offense to the man who owns the house, but it was a creepy, creepy house. So no matter which way you cut it, the rooms that we weren't shooting in where you'd go and, you know, sit in your chair and have a Diet Coke were creepy. So the tone was dark and weird, and you needed your cell phone flashlight to even walk out of the house to get something from Crafty. So the tone was there. It made our jobs easier. For sure.
I like the cinematography in it because I noticed, yeah, especially with the house, when every time they enter, there's that big patio and they're literally going into darkness. I'm like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
You're going into the darkest house ever. So I think that's, you know, great to hear.
It was amazing. Mark Spicer, who did who's our cinematographer, was amazing. He does a lot of the Fast and Furious stuff. He's a really established, wonderful guy. And the tone is set, you know, obviously. Rebecca's mother likes to keep the house dark so she can have her friend around. And so if we're going to step into it, we're going to be going into her world. And then we have to bring our own little extra sources to keep ourselves safe.
How much did you guys talk about the rules of that world? Because, you know, obviously, you know, it's very much kind of like a mystery at first. And then we're slowly introduced into this. And, you know, just by the title, you kind of get the concept. But, you know, it's like the black light later on, that's a new introduction.
Yeah.
It's a twist.
Well, that was like a, you know, they figured that out as they went along. You know, they're in the basement, they're figuring out ways about it. And this wasn't like, is the black light going to work? We just find out the black light does work. That, you know, we can see Diana, but she doesn't disappear in the light and therefore can, you know, inflict some sort of harm on her.
Yeah. How much did you guys like talk about that ahead of time? Or was that just always in the script and you guys were told?
I don't remember
rules?
The black light part, but I do remember really, you know, working a lot on these, you know, when I did the cell phone move, you know, yeah. I had this
huge cheers.
I had this huge light. Well, we shot it like my way with the cell phone like that. And then there was another way where we shot it where, you know, Teresa and I joked that we should get credits as like lighting people because we did a lot of our own lighting. Like her black light scenes, like that was how she was lit, was the black light. And then for the cell phone scene, when you see it bouncing off the walls, I was holding this cell phone with huge lights rigged on it that would bounce off the walls. So we did like all those little gags you see us doing with flashlights and candles. That's it. There weren't extra light sources. So we used those as our light sources for filming as well, which was
Is that, you know how you have to, because you have to hit your mark in a certain way, right? Are you now like also, when you say you should get lighting credit, like are you told very specifically of how the lighting should go?
Yeah, you are. And they'd be like, while we were shooting, they'd be like, all right, Alexander, put it to the left, up the stairwell a little bit. All right, pull it back down. And then, you know, when you go in the house, put the flashlight over there to the right and then to the left of the door, but not too left. So it was like we had like hitting our marks and then hitting our lighting marks as well, which was – that was the first time somebody's asked me that. Good question. Yeah, it was it was funny. It's funny thinking back on it. Yeah, we did have to hit these little marks all the time.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Especially because that's how – you know, it's – you know, when I'm banging on the basement door, you flash up, you don't see Diana, you flash down, she appears. And so it's a matter of timing those things.
It's just an extra challenge on top of everything you already have to do. But, you know, props to you guys for that. And we know the house is pretty creepy, and we heard that the basement was
on fire
afterwards.
Yeah, like a week or two after we finished shooting.
Wow, that's creepy.
Yeah.
So, like,
very creepy.
Do you believe in, like, the spirits?
Do I believe that we haunted that house?
Maybe.
I mean, maybe. No, I don't believe that, but possibly.
Well, okay.
Are you open to the idea?
Yeah, I'm open to the idea of it. I'm open to the idea of it.
Teresa,
if somebody can prove it to me, I'll say yes.
Teresa has her stories of growing up in a haunted house, and now she thinks, like, right, her
house. Yeah, her house is haunted now.
Do you joke? Like, do you believe her, or... Or you just kind of...
I don't know. I mean, you can't question these women with these ghost stories, you know? Then the ghost attacks you and you're in trouble.
Right.
It happened in her story, you know? Her husband doubts the ghost and the mirror breaks.
All right, so you just...
I mean, go with it.
If a mirror is involved, that's kind of creepy.
Yeah, you know... But. We rented a beach house one summer when we were kids that ended up being dubbed the haunted house because stuff would happen in the house, doors being slammed and I think someone's bag got unpacked without them unpacking it and stuff. And I still to this day don't know if it's like just this elaborate lie my parents kept going for years or the house was haunted. I'm not going to doubt it.
Speaking of the haunting, right? So can you talk to us about Diana and like how that, you know, obviously it's an actress portraying her and you know, she's known for doing these roles. But how's that like, you know, just kind of seeing it in real life versus, you know, on film? Because I've only seen it on film.
It makes, firstly, it made our jobs much easier to have practical effects as opposed to special effects. We had somebody in a very intimidating suit with, you know, fingers that were like 12 inches long attacking us throughout the film. So it made our job as actors a lot easier. We weren't playing against a green screen. It was nothing like that. And then it was absolutely frightening just to see her walking around set because she, as you saw in the film, she does all these kind of wonderful movements and, you know, creaky, crawly type things. She was amazing. And seeing it on set was much like you saw it on screen.
Have you seen her do those moves but not in the weird suit?
No. I mean, I didn't – I think it wasn't until we finished filming that I actually saw her face. And she was so sweet. She'd be like, hi, Alex. Nice to meet you. I'm Alicia. I'm like, oh, really nice to meet you. I can't look at you right now. You're scaring me. So it was wild. It was wild because she was really nice, but she was really scary, and she the physical embodiment of this character made it so much better. And it's what you see, you know, when there may be a few little scenes of added special effects in the film, but for the most part, it's just this woman doing that. And we'd shoot, you know, like, for example, when I said the flashlight scene in the door where she's there and then she's not, you know, we'd shoot it once with the light without her and then once with the light with her. So it wasn't like CGIing her into it. She was there. They just, you know, edited it well.
Very neat. I found her absolutely terrifying because even at the end of this film, you know, at night, I made sure my TV was still on, you know, when
get
I went
a little
to bed.
Light.
I turned off the lights eventually, but like she had such a scary, horrifying performance. Yeah. I mean, she did so well during
amazing.
That.
Like, Teresa, we did an interview with her on the red carpet, and she apologized to all the fans for their electricity bill.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. You're going to be keeping the lights on for sure. It definitely gets you. It definitely got us while we were shooting because it does play in that really primal fear of you have no idea what's there. Or, you know, you're staying in a place you don't really know, and you think something's there, and it's just your garment bag hanging on the closet, but you convince yourself it's something every time.
Yeah, I'm amazed. Like, I applaud this movie on so many levels. The fact that, like, you know, such a simple concept that, like, has always been there, but someone hasn't done anything with, and then this movie is able to capitalize on. And the fact that, like, a lot of reviewers are applauding it, that it doesn't just rely on jump scares and things like that. It goes to a deeper level.
Well, I think also because, like you said, you do care about these characters and the story they're going through, it makes those scares much more intense. You know, they are – obviously, there are some jump scares in the film. But in caring about these characters and what they're going through, it makes it that much scary. It makes it that much worse, you know?
Mm-hmm. And I think it's not just the whole idea of going off the primal fear of darkness, but also the concept of, you know, monsters in the closet, monsters under the bed. So, like, they had those added elements to it.
Oh, we had it all, pulling you under the bed, right?
Yeah,
you know,
terrifying.
I used to do this move where I'd count my steps to the bed and then jump at the last second to get in bed when I was a kid so nothing could grab me under the bed. Sure enough, you know, Martin gets dragged under the bed in our film in that one scene.
So speaking of how, you know, I mean, Gabriel Bateman, he's making quite a name for himself in the horror genre.
Creepy kid. And, he's the sweetest kid in the world.
What was it like to work with him? I mean, he was so young, but already, you know, pretty accomplished.
Yeah, very established. His whole family, I think it's like 9 kids and 10 of them are actors.
Wow.
Well, his sister's in Annabelle 2 right now shooting. It was awesome working with him. I think I was used to working with kids that could be very moody and, you know, 5 minutes into it, you're like ready to just leave. But he was an unbelievable professional and also really sweet and wonderful working with a open-eyed, bright-eyed kid who was like eager to learn things beyond movies, just like talk about stuff. You know, I remember talking about the subway system in New York with him. You know, he was like eager and fun and happy. So it made a lot of our off-camera time, whether it was with Gabriel or with Tez, was just really nice and fun. And he was like any other little kid, just a little bit smarter and maybe at times a little creepier. On screen.
Well, you know, this movie is getting like really positive reviews from the fans and whatnot, and it was also at Comic-Con. You just went to your first Comic-Con.
I did go to my first Comic-Con.
So how's the fan reaction been like?
Fan reaction's been pretty awesome. Fans, I think there were so many fans of this short. Our rollout continues till the end of August in Europe, you know, and all my European friends had seen this short way before I had, because I think it was really big over there, because he's Swedish, or I don't know what it was. But the fans so far, the U.S.-based fans, have really loved it. I think we attract a lot of James Wan fans here and a lot of horror fans, and I think as we roll out worldwide, we're going to attract people who'd seen the short originally when it went viral. And that's really going to get them excited by it. I think this weekend we do some much larger rollouts.
Ah, very cool.
And you guys just announced a sequel to this. Like anything beyond that you can tell us?
I know nothing beyond that, except I just hope it's as good as our first one. I'm texting and emailing our producers every day like, hey, you guys got any ideas? You want me to come in and, you know, talk a little bit?
Right. It's interesting because, you know, spoiler alert and whatnot, but the fact that Diana is gone, but she was a mental kind of projection and affected one person, but do you think she can affect more people?
For sure. I mean, more people she affects this woman who, you know, can make an argument that she's in, allegorically speaking, like a metaphor for depression in a sense, you know. Depression's genetic, maybe her daughter's depressed.
Well, I did think that was a very good question from Martin when he says, you know, hey, if mom's crazy, does that mean we're crazy?
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, kind of left open in that regard.
It's a great question, and I think we can address that in the sequel if anybody's listening.
I think we could. You know, I mean, well, David right now, he's shooting Annabelle 2, so
I think they got our writer, Eric, like, working already, probably. My guess is. If they're going to announce it in the trades, they're probably already on it.
Yeah, absolutely. And how does that make you feel to know like that this movie's doing so well that like just a couple days after it comes out?
It's really weird. It's pretty shocking, to be honest. This is my first lead in a studio film like this. So on Monday, everybody's like, how do you feel? I was like, the same way I felt on Friday. Just like watching Netflix, sitting on my couch. And the next day, they're like, everyone's emailing me like, sequel. I was like, oh, amazing. Like, what does that mean? Is that good? Like, this is good, right? That means people like the movie. And my manager's like, yes, people like the movie. It's humbling. It's amazing. I haven't quite processed it yet. I mean, I haven't gotten a script yet or a contract, but it looks like I've already got another job, possibly, which is awesome. It's a lot to take in. It's a testament to people obviously really caring about this movie and liking these characters and wanting to see more out of them.
Yeah, I mean, from a box office perspective, it exceeded expectations. You know, opening weekend.
Yeah, we've had a great week so far. It's awesome. We're cruising. Yeah. It's awesome.
And there's no competition in that space.
No.
At the moment. You know,
I don't think till the end of the summer, basically.
Yeah, and the only competition, like Conjuring 2, you know, it's still on a couple of screens.
They've made their
but...
$300-plus million yeah, right. for now, guys, all right? Give us our you know, our due.
I like the fact that this film came out in the summer compared to, you know, October, where all the other horror films come out and kind of gets, you know,
I think,
lost
it got... You know, they test these films and they fill out scorecards and all this stuff, and it tested really well. And to me, again, that was like, I didn't really comprehend what that meant. It's testing so well. I'm like, all right, guys, like, what does that mean? And they're like, oh, we might come out in the fall. And I was like, I don't want to come out in the fall, because originally they were going to maybe try and do it for spring. And then they were like, it's coming out in July. I'm like, it's coming out in July. That's a pretty big deal, right? And they're like, yeah, that's a huge deal. It's the same weekend as the original Conjuring. I was like, again, I don't know what this means. Like, what, we're going to follow this marketing strategy. You know, it was all over my head. But for us to come out in the summer, the same weekend as a film like Star Trek, was you know, testament to the studio's belief in the story and to where it could go.
I think it definitely worked.
Yeah.
Definitely.
So far it's working, I guess.
We'll work again for the sequel.
Yes. Next summer. July 22nd.
There you go. I mean, why not?
Why not?
And so talk about your other roles, right? So you've done TV as well.
Yeah.
And now, what's the switch from like TV to movies for you?
Well, I've been working on this Amazon show now, which isn't a huge switch. I found these Netflix, Amazon limited series or cable shows. They use a lot of film directors. It shoots similar, but, you know, a huge difference between film and TV is you really got to nail your lines on TV, right? They've got it down to a formula of how long each show is by the minute, and the writer has a way they're presenting the story. That's your biggest difference, is you really got to nail your lines. You got to be on top of your stuff.
Meaning timing-wise, or just like timing-wise in the
timing-wise,
sense that
you have to say exactly what they write, mm-hmm. you know, and film, you can have a little mess up, and the director's like, you know, we're just working through our scene, you know, we're just getting it off the ground, we're taking it from here, and you have that freedom. I mean, if I had my way, I'd just do film all the time. It's fun, it's exciting. You get to embody a new character every time you play a role, but you also have these amazing, you know, we're just talking about Stranger Things, you have these amazing shows on Netflix and Amazon that are coming out from great writers, great studios, great directors, making amazing things that you aren't expecting, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I'm excited for Good Girls Revolt. I've known about this series for a while now, but to have that on Amazon, just like a whole nother platform to be
for
out
sure.
there.
For sure. It's exciting. It's also period, which is really fun. We get to wear bell bottoms and all these really amazingly warm clothes. When you're shooting in Santa Clarita, don't wear wool. Head to toe, it's brutal.
60s, right?
Yeah, 69, 70, post-Vietnam. My character is a war veteran with what we would now call PTSD, but back then just thought somebody was a little bit crazy because they didn't really understand that people would have these lasting effects from war. It took a long time to figure that out. This show lends a little insight into that process, as well as insight into the rise of feminism and bra burning, et cetera, stuff like that.
Very cool. And what would be a character that you wanted to play, if you could?
Like in a movie, or like am I making it like a specific movie, or am I making up a
the
character?
Type of just, role that you always wanted to do.
You know, I like anybody who goes against what people think they're going to do. I think that's why this role of Brett was really great. You know, people expect him to be one person, but he's really another. And I think anybody who, you know, I don't know if expectations are right, but anybody that goes against the stereotype, anybody that changes the way that people think they're going to go is a fun character to play. Mm-hmm. There's a million dream roles, you know, out there. Every time you go to the movies, you're like, oh, my God, this would be a great role to play, whether it's a bad guy fighting for a good cause or, you know, a good guy. You're not quite sure if you want to root for him or not. Anybody that makes an audience think are the roles that I'd like to go after, you know, or be part of.
Very cool. And where can fans follow you to kind of keep most up to date?
I just got on Instagram a few months ago.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Do you use it that often or just kind of still playing around?
Well, I was a lot of – it was playing around, and now I'm using it, I guess. I mean, I was using it to help promote the film, and I guess I'll use it for Good Girls Revolt and then decide how much insight into my – normal life will go. I'm a little intimidated by social media. It's a lot.
Overwhelming.
It is overwhelming. It's definitely overwhelming. It's a matter of finding a balance, I think.
Absolutely.
But I was told, like, the studio loves when you do this. You got to do this. And I'm like, oh, God. It was, like, such an internal fight going on.
There's obviously the negative side. But, like, again, with something like this, like, Lights Out, like, you know, are you seeing a lot? Are you interacting with the fans? Because, I mean, that must feel good when you get, like, tweets or something like that.
Yeah, there's a little bit of interaction going on. It's, like, very complimentary, but you can't interact with everybody. It's overwhelming, like I said. It's nice. It's amazing to just have the concept of fans, you know. It's a very cool thing.
Internet's amazing. You know, even, like, Snapchat's, like, the big thing right now. So you're on Snapchat.
I'm not on Snapchat. Something inappropriate would happen if I was on Snapchat.
I don't understand Snapchat. Yeah. And I should understand
Snapchat. I don't really understand it either. I knew that, like, Gabriel did some Snapchat takeovers for, like, various mediums while we were on. I know there was a Lights Out filter on Snapchat.
Oh, wow.
Oh, that's creepy. Yeah, I can imagine what that looks like.
I've got screenshots of it, but I never did it because I don't use Snapchat.
There you go.
I mean, I got to imagine Diana's kind of in the background or something.
Yeah, like I think what it is you make a scary face and then Diana pops up and like you send that to your friends or however Snapchat works.
Oh, no, that's terrible.
Yeah.
That is a horrible joke to play on people.
Yeah.
We had like a running joke after we saw the film, like anything wrong that goes here in the studios, we just blame Diana.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah.
I still
Diana.
Use that in my regular life.
Yeah, there you go.
It's always her fault.
Yeah, it's always, it's been her fault for a good year now.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Pleasure. And again, I can't say enough about this movie. So congratulations.
Thanks so much.
And I genuinely look forward to the second one. Seeing where Brett goes from there.
Yeah, yeah. Brett, he's loyal as a dog. This guy.
Absolutely. He just wanted one sock. I mean, to write that
just
in.
Just one sock.
And the poor prick, like his little rainbow-colored
yeah,
sock.
Yeah, come flying out the window, hits him in the face. That scene, that was probably the longest scene it took to film. It was like a matter of Tez throwing a sock that would like somehow come directly to me. And it was like, sock over there, sock over there, sock over there. That took a lot.
I give you guys credit because, yeah, you guys normally, like, it would be cut every which way, but it was a...
It literally took forever to shoot that scene. And then I was catching it lefty, and then I was like, oh, nobody catches lefty. He's like, yeah, you're righty. You catch lefty, you throw righty. I was like, all right, damn it, they're right. Okay, I'm going to practice this thing and get it right.
Is that how it works?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Baseball.
There you go. Yes, well, thank you, for coming in, and congratulations on,
so much.
The success of this film. And I'm not much of a horror person, but I'll see the second one when that comes out.
I appreciate
that. There you go.
Well, all right, guys, we're going to cut to a quick commercial break as we say bye to Alex, but we'll continue on, so stay tuned. Awesome. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, Anatomy of Movie fans. Again, we're talking Lights Out. That was Alex...
DePersia.
That's it. You know what? I'm glad we had him. He gave us a couple of insights. And so now Marissa and I will continue, and we'll kind of fill in the gaps on some of the stuff that we didn't get to talk about, in terms of the filmmaking process of this. By the way, you can download our rundown for the show in the description section so you can kind of follow along, and anything that we don't get to, can kind of find there. But one of the questions that we asked him was about the short film. Had he seen it? So to start at the beginning, David Sandberg, he made a short film with his wife. It's a 2-minute horror film. You can catch it on YouTube.
Terrifying. Oh my God, it's terrifying. Yes. I watched it in like pure lit area, and I'm like, oh my God, why? Why am I watching this? It is
because Phil made you.
Absolutely horrifying. I'm not a horror person.
Absolutely. And it went viral. He put it in Britain's Bloody Cuts Horror Challenge. It didn't win, but he was named Best Director. And after that, it went viral. And that's what kind of led to this. And so a lot of people, after it went viral, many people actually, Lawrence Gray, who was one of the producers, he had a similar experience to you. He was like watching in his office. He's like, why am I scared? All the lights are on.
Yeah,
exactly. It's daylight outside.
Well, I think that's just a testament of the concept and how simple of an idea that was, but how well it was shot. I mean, it can evoke such a scary emotion within 2.5 minutes. So props to them. Plus, I'm just a big wuss when it comes to horror.
But it's also prime, you know, right? David said, like, you know, this stuff happens to every single one of us. Like, we're always checking, like, wait, did I see something? Did I not?
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. as I said earlier, like, the fact that no one's done this concept is incredible to me, and they've tapped into something really special.
Especially scary.
Yes.
Yeah, special.
And, you know, one of the things we did, this is a couple things that I like about this movie. It's so quick and efficient. Mm-hmm. At 81 minutes, that's including credits. It wastes no time. It knows what it is, you know, and you can just kind of, if you have, like the way I stole Marissa, right, and I stole somebody else, but it was one of the ways I presented to other people was like, hey, if you have a couple extra, like, you know, if you have, give or take 60 minutes, go see this movie. Because it can be that quick, you know, and you're not wasting
Absolutely.
Too much time watching it.
I mean, what I enjoyed about this film was that it wasted no time in telling the story to a point where, like, we can easily understand what's happening. There was a good back story set up, and we understood where Diana came from, where the connection was to the mother, where the connection is to the rest of the family. And it wasn't, like, convoluted. It was very thought out and very well produced in that way. So, but it took a little bit amount of time, but I understood it. And then, you know, we're always talking about pacing. They're always moving from room to room or house to apartment and back and whatnot. So, like, the pace was pretty on point.
And the longest scene that I remember was the actual opening scene. You know, that was very slow and methodical.
Right.
And that's what sort of set up the world, and we don't obviously know quite what the hell is going on. And interestingly enough, like, the mannequins were part of that location. So, yeah, you're kind of thrown off. It throws you off in that regard of, like, wait, am I supposed to be scared of the mannequins? Because they're creepy as hell.
They are. Like, and even I'm watching at the beginning, I'm actually pretty fun to watch horror films because I'm the kind of person, like, what are you doing? Why are the mannequins there? Like, what purpose do they serve? Who works in a place with creepy mannequins like that?
I was wondering what his job was.
Yeah, I mean, like, some type of factory, but I'm like, what the hell are these random mannequins doing here? Very scary, though. Creepy. But I'm glad that, like, they threw that in there to, like, make us kind of afraid, but they're not the things that we should be afraid of.
Yeah, it's this creepy
it's
one.
It's like misdirection, kind of.
You know, and it's, again, it set up a lot of those things. Even, so as we talked about with Alex, when he's running away from the house and he goes through the kind of garage area, right? And he goes into the darkness and then she gets him. It's obviously very similar. It was because it was set up early on in the film when the dad's leg gets you know, taken, and you looked at me of like, why, what happened? Well, now we know.
Yeah, now we know that she's in the dark.
You know, and so okay, so again, kind of going back, Lawrence Gray, he loves this, and it's one of those movies that he knew he could make on a micro budget. The budget for this is $4.5 million. You know, is steep in some sense for an indie movie, but for a horror movie, like, and especially if they believed in it, it can make its money back.
And if you think about it, there's really only like three main locations they used. I mean, well, four if you include the school and whatnot, but three big filming locations was like the house, the apartment, and that warehouse they were at the beginning. So production was pretty small if you think about it.
Overall, very much so, you know, and it was Gray's idea to get James Wan involved. They had known each other before. It was actually Lawrence Gray who heard the first pitch for Saw, and unfortunately his studio at the time did not take it. And he still regrets that to this day.
Hindsight.
But they've always kind of kept in touch and wanted to work together, and so that's how James Wan came aboard, was through a phone call and whatnot, and then, you know, then it came into it, but they both knew that while it was a great concept, in terms of there's many limitations of the short film to basically then translate it to a full on feature. It needed fleshing out.
Yeah, you got
to
flesh it out, create padding and story and whatnot. And you know, we've talked about other films that, you know, started off either on like conceptual development pictures or another short story and whatnot. But I think it's great that what they added to this to make it a full length is like an actual good dramatic story, which I said at the top of the show, that they added a family element, and I think that immediately makes it relatable to people along with the horror aspect underneath.
Yeah, and they recruited a great, great screenwriter, Eric, who has done The Thing, Nightmare on Elm Street, and a lot of just horror in general. And so, you know, and I think this might be one of his, even out of those, like this might still be one of my favorite movies that he's probably scripted.
Oh, Lights Out?
Lights Out, because I don't know. He was able to blend these characters, a concept, and humor. This movie had a ton of humor.
There was a lot of humor, thanks to, you know, Brett. But, yeah, I was surprised because every time they were in darkness, you knew something was going to happen. It was one of those movies, like, when it was daytime, for the most part, you're safe. When it's nighttime, good Lord, help us all.
Absolutely, and one of, again, the way that the movie progressed, I love the fact that the mother introduces Martin. She's like, you know, let's have you and me time. We need to spend a little bit, and it'll be just the three of us. And immediately he knows, what?
Who's the third?
And then when she turns off the lights and starts introducing Diana.
Yeah, no. No, like, and the problem was, like, she was holding the kid's hand. I was like, no, someone hold my hand, because, like, we could see and, like, hear Diana, like, slowly walking up behind the kid. Like, this is absolutely terrifying.
But it works. What I appreciate about that scene is that it works on the horrific level because the kid's scared out of his mind. And yet, here's Diana, the mother, who's saying, like, no, don't be afraid. Yeah, Sophie, don't be afraid. She doesn't know any better. And the fact that, like, she's as her... Like, we're all scared as an audience members, but the fact that she's, like, trying to find a way to forgive this is more... To me, almost more troubling.
Yeah, she can't control her behavior.
Yeah.
It's... And I think that was interesting to have that, like, the mother was so connected to Diana. The fact that she wanted to introduce Diana to the family, be like, no, she's just... one of us. She's just a little bit more troubled.
Yeah.
So it's messed up.
It was very messed up, but one of the core concepts, and you know what, in hindsight, I wish we talked about it with Alex, was this notion of abandonment. You know, because early on, right, Becca's father, he abandoned them. Obviously, he did not. We learned that. But the fact that then Becca abandons Sophie and whatnot, and obviously Sophie feels like she abandoned Diana, there's that strange part of, like, okay, what does that mean? What is this, you know, who's right in this equation? Who's wrong? And can you abandon somebody, or does it lead to this?
Or, yeah, if you do abandon someone, they're going to come back after you. That is a more deep notion, and I think it's great because I think that, you know, in parallel with the whole family element, that makes it, again, more real and realistic to understand. Because, and it's not just with families, like, friends feel like they've been abandoned and whatnot, but I like the fact that there's, like, three kind of generations that this happened. We had, you know, the mother with a friend, and then we had the daughter, and then we had a kid. So it was, like, three different ages where this abandonment lies through.
And, you know, even beyond that, the father of Diana herself. Because, you know, she's in my head and whatnot. This has been going on. It's one of those things, what I appreciate most about it is that it doesn't reveal too much. And what I mean by that is, you know, there's Becca, and she's asking, like, hey, so who is she? And Sophie says, I don't believe in ghosts. Like, yeah. Okay, but
so if she's not a ghost, then what is she?
Yeah, and we never obviously get that answer. Besides, obviously, we just formulate our own opinion that she's a mental projection. But obviously, it's more than just a mental projection; it's a physical.
And then we were talking after we just saw the movie. That was one of my issues with the film. It's like, if it's a mental projection, how does it have the ability going from mental to something tangible where it can, like, physically move things and move people and hurt them in a physical aspect?
I'm going to tell you this. It's just like Sharknadoes. How do they happen? They just happen.
They just happen.
That's it. That's it. That's the only explanation you need sometimes.
Suspend the disbelief a little bit more.
Because, you know, at the end of the day, no no explanation is going to be satisfying enough. So why go through that?
But I think that was my way of coping with horror after the tragedy I just saw. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, I have to understand this in some way so I can feel better. But that was one of the biggest looming questions I had. If it's a mental, how did it become tangible?
Well, that is a big question. Speaking of that, right, I want to ask you about, we'll talk about some of the horror more scary moments, but in terms of, I do want to talk about the ending in particular, because was that satisfying? It kind of, the way the script was going about and the way the movie kind of went, it seemed, you know, it lent itself to that, right? Because the pills were gone. I was really hoping that somehow, again, she would be helped, mm-hmm. and then that's how Diana would leave, which, again, in some sense, makes for a better sequel, because it kind of, again, there's that looming question of, like, if she gets off the meds, this girl's back. Exactly. Now, how is Diana going to
Yeah, and that return? Was my question. I was like, okay, she's gone, so... But, I mean, to answer the first question, yes, I think it was satisfying, but also I think it was also very predictable, too, because there was a whole line where Sophie was like, you're nothing without me. I'm like, oh, great. She only goes away when Sophie goes away in some shape or form. Like, the only way to actually officially get rid of Diana is to kill her, so that means you're going to have to kill Sophie. Like, yeah. So I understood that and figured that out. So it was satisfying when, like, it came to fruition.
I just, I love this movie. I'm dissatisfied with the ending, but what I like, it was so much fun watching the movie, and as gruesome it was to kind of see these, this family and going through all this, you know, and pain and horror, whatever the case may be. At that moment, things just changed. They got very dark. Mm-hmm. And then the movie kind of ends after that. So it was like I was having fun with this. And then at that point, I was like, oh, shoot, it's actually real.
That's it.
That's it, yeah. You know, and so...
Because they pull away from the house, and literally that's how it ends.
Yeah, and again, in terms of... Like, I feel bad for the mother, but I also feel bad for Becca, because there she goes through the basement. Luckily, Martin doesn't really see what happened, and I don't know if he would necessarily have the same connection, but there's Becca seeing, like, what happened, the real truth about her father, mm-hmm. that he was in this basement and he was locked away and that's how he died, and then she literally sees now the demise of her mother because of this thing.
Because of Diana. I felt bad, too, because, yes, Sophie's now dead, but also I thought, I was like, oh, no, now they're orphans. And yeah. that just, like, left a really bad resonating picture for me. I was like, oh, no. So, like, who else do they have now other than just themselves?
Well, it'll be interesting what Child Protective Services says. Because, again, now you have to kind of, like, how do you explain
poor
Diana?
Martin.
Yeah, because they're not going to believe Becca that much.
No, like, Martin's going to probably go into foster care and be jaded. Maybe Diana will come back for Martin, because he seems like he'd be the most mentally unstable person. I mean...
That's true.
We get that Rebecca, she's been through a lot of things, but she's older, so she probably has more ability to cope with everything that just went on. Whereas Martin, being a kid, being scarred, and now an orphan, it makes sense if he was the one being tortured.
We need writing credit on this one.
Right?
We're just making this thing happen. Now, you know, we've applauded Alex in this. Teresa Palmer... absolutely fantastic.
Love her.
It was James Wan's idea to bring her in. I didn't get to read too much into this, but I did read one article at least that said Teresa's mother actually suffered from mental illness. I wasn't able to get more specifics than that, but you know, obviously if that's true and to what extent, I'm sure she was able to draw from that.
Yeah, absolutely. And also Teresa said in interviews, because it has been a family... related thing with her, that like she, that helped draw her to just the project itself, because she could relate, so she wanted to do it because she knew what the experience was like being a daughter of someone who's had a mental problem such as this as well, that like she found it very relatable, and she wanted to immediately do this project.
Yeah, and she's a mother herself now, so it kind of takes on a whole sort of meaning to her. You know, one of the fun things that I in terms of Alicia, right? We asked Alex about her, but Teresa says seeing her as Diana, I couldn't connect with her in that way anymore because she's behind the suit. She has these crazy contact lenses. She's so scary to look at. When she's in the scene, I'm literally afraid just because I'm staring at her. And they know each other from
I Am Number Four.
I Am Number Four.
Which is a great film because I just watched that recently, like last week. Coincidentally as well. And I think that's great to, you know, always, you know, be working with someone that you've already, worked on a project with, but in a completely different sense than the first one in I Am Number Four, if you've ever seen that film. There's, like, a lot of stunts. There's a lot of fighting scenes going on. So you know how they work together. But in this one, it's, like, way more dramatic, less action, but more just, like, the character suspense of acting. And it's nice to see, like, two actresses, like, on the flip side of what they started off with and what they were doing in this one.
Absolutely. Speaking of Diana, they used, you know, we've kind of talked about it, they used a prosthetic suit for it, and it was built by someone who did the character for Mrs. Doubtfire.
So great kind film. Of,
you know, obviously someone that's worked in this space a long time and whatnot, so, you know.
Creepy. And I was trying to look up actual suit of Diana, or the, you know, prosthetic suit that she wore, but I couldn't see anything. So the only thing that I've seen was on film, and most of that was in darkness. So I've never seen, like, a full clear image of what Diana actually looks like, which makes it all the more scary because it still leaves it up to the audience of how you can delineate her as a picture.
Yeah. You know, she did a fantastic job. Absolutely fantastic. Couple of Easter eggs in Rebecca's room. There's a poster Slacked, which again, just some of the weirdest posters on purpose. But Slacked translates in Swedish to lights out. So
those posters were very creepy. Especially, I loved how she was very self-aware in the film. It's like, there are pictures that might scare you. And I was trying to look at the first one when we were first introduced to Teresa, because I remember the shot was like the wall pictures and then Teresa. I'm like, okay, is this character, is this like a foreshadowing aspect of that we'll see Teresa go through in the darkness? But look cool.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, all right, so let's talk about David Sandberg, right? We talked about his short, but now let's talk about him directing. And from what we learned with Alex, he's apparently a very calm guy. You know, and he was cautioned, he says, it just went really fast and really smooth, and people kept telling me, don't get used to that, because that's not how it usually happens.
Filming, no. Usually, like, there's always obstacles, and you always have to, like, plan to, like, okay, how do we change this, or how do we fix this, whatever. So, the fact that this went fairly smoothly for his directorial debut, good for him.
I mean, there's, you know, even though the budget's not huge for a blockbuster summer movie, the fact that, again, they put it up against Star Trek Beyond, that's writing a lot. And so much so, like, they're giving him Annabelle 2. Like, that's what he's off doing right now.
Wow. It's good for him to, and then also probably working with James Wan again. So, I mean, and I like the fact that, like, he had the idea already, and then he could easily flesh it out to full feature, so it's nothing, like, really new to him. He was already part of this project from the beginning.
Yeah. And here's what Maria Bello said about him. David has such a great and gentle hand. Knew what he wanted, but also didn't have a big ego about it. Gave us actors a sense of comfort that we felt free to be the best of ourselves. So,
and coming from Maria Bello, who's super established in and of herself, and about a first-time full-length director, says a lot.
It does indeed. It does indeed. And you know what? I mean, one of the things that I think made this smooth, though, as I kind of look at it, right? A lot of the people that worked on this were people that have worked with James Wan. And, you know, Mark Spicer, the cinematographer, he did Furious 7. You know, he's a cameraman on Fast 8. He did The Shallows and Son of the Mask.
It's a very experienced crew as well who knows this genre.
Absolutely.
That's great.
Kristen M. Burke did the costume design. She's known for Conjuring, Insidious, and whatnot. So, again, in that space, knowing these guys. And
then, I think it's interesting. If you find it real, like, all those horror films have, like, a strong female spirit antagonist in that film, along with Lights Out. I wonder why it's the women who are the antagonist. Interesting.
Well,
I don't know. No, I just realized that. I was like, all those have, like, a female antagonist as the, you know, the main scary bad, the big baddie of the film.
Well, it's because everyone's keeping Alicia employed. I mean, she's in most of those movies.
Yeah. You know, good for her.
Like, that's her. Obviously, she's in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and whatnot and kind of other things now more so as an actress, not just being a stunt woman. But, you know, the way she described, like, she loves portraying this role because she loves to scare people. So, you know, I think she'll continue doing it.
Oh, absolutely. And it's not just horror, too, but, like, she can just do a lot of action as well. I believe she's a Kate Beckinsale stunt woman for Underworld. Mm-hmm. So, good for her. She's working.
Indeed. And so, in terms of the editing, Mike Aller and Kirk and Maury, they edited this, and so, again, continuing the theme, Annabelle 2, The Boy Next Door, they've worked on all these, Conjuring 2, Furious 7, Insidious 2, and one of my favorites, Piranha 3 Double D.
You love Piranha.
Piranha's a good movie.
Yes, we've seen that together.
Piranha 3D is a good movie. Piranha 3D
Film forces me to watch a lot of movies outside my comfort zone. We have seen that film.
Sometimes you have to. You make me watch crappy musicals and...
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that's good. I'm trying to think, because this is a short film. I don't think it needed to be much longer.
Nah, if I can't imagine what you would have added. And the fact that it has so few characters works really well towards it. I don't think you need it, you know. No. The music, obviously, was very great.
Scary.
Benjamin Wallfisch composed it. He's known more as an orchestrator / conductor. He's, you know, those are the bigger movies that he's done, like Atonement, V for Vendetta, Robin Hood, Eat, Pray, Love, 12 Years a Slave. And so this is, he's done...
lighter movies.
Yeah. Well, he's composed for other movies, but so now it's great to kind of see him do this and really be a composer rather than just a conductor and orchestrator.
Good for him. And, like, all those films, they're so vastly different from each other. Like, all the... You have Eat, Pray, Love, which is romance, and then Atonement, which is also romance, but, like, drama periods and whatnot. So it's great when he can span, like, so many different genres and evoke different emotions. Because even listening to the music for this film, I was scared the crap out of just trying to get the music for this one. And, like, I didn't want to listen to more than just the trailer music. So good for him.
Indeed. All right, so let's get into box office. This thing's doing so well. Last I checked, $33 million overall. So
wow, for horror, that's great.
Well, but look at it this way, right? How often it made about $15 million opening weekend, right? Give or take. It's basically a 3x that's a multiplier three times. Of three.
Yeah.
Right. That's what movie can say that opening weekend.
Not a lot. And I think that's why there's so many horror films, too, because they're easy to film, they're usually low budget, and so many people love it.
Well, they need to be good. I mean, there's some pretty bad ones. But so far, Conjuring 2 has been great. People are loving The Shallows. And now this. So, again, the movies that we've seen, for me, I really enjoy. Mm-hmm. But Purge Anarchy, not for me.
Yeah. But 3D Piranha is for you.
Hey, listen, that holds a special place.
Lights Out. I mean, I've seen the first Conjuring. I didn't see the second Conjuring, but I have seen Annabelle. That's probably one of the only other horror films that I have covered for Anatomy. And that was horribly terrifying as well. I forced Dimitri to go with me to see that. Like, I can't see these movies by myself. No.
Well, luckily, there's at any one of the... You can go at 10 a.m., I'm sure, and there will be enough people to see Lights Out with. and have fun with.
Yeah, but I don't want to walk away and not talk to someone about it, you know? I got to talk to anybody. Someone about it.
Talk to anybody. 78% on Rotten Tomatoes. As the site says, Lights Out makes skillful use of sturdy genre tropes and some terrific performances for an unsettling, fright-filled experience that delivers superior chills without skimping on story. I agree.
I completely agree.
And audiences give it a B.
I'm surprised.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not a fan of horror, but I would give this an A for horror. I've actually seen a good amount of horror, unfortunately, but I would give this an A.
Yeah, you know, I think it's just a lot of fun, so, and obviously we're getting the second one, so, you know, we have that to look forward to. All right, well, what was your most scary moment of the movie?
Oh, goodness. You know what? I know. Okay, so when Teresa is in her apartment at night and the whole tattoo sign, mm-hmm. and that neon sign keeps flashing, and then we see Diana every time it goes, you know, off and whatnot. But, like, it was the moment where Diana's, like, actually physically going towards Diana, or, like, towards Teresa and about to attack her. I was like, oh, no. No, thank you. No, thank you. And then there was the one moment she was, like, actually going to touch Teresa, or, like, and you know, Rebecca. And I'm like, oh, nope. Close the eyes. Avert the eyes, you know. Oh, God. It's horrible. Like, knowing something's physically coming at you, that is a horrible feeling.
Well, I liked what I liked about that scene was how they set it up, because they kind of almost do it as an establishing shot, and you're like, oh, okay, but then it takes on a different meaning, right? They twist it on that, because again, just to shoot a outside exterior shot of an apartment building with like a sign that's kind of rickety, you're like, oh, and they held on it for quite a bit, so I was like, why are we watching this?
This means something. But also, like, that scene, you had the added feature of just the sound scratching on the wood, which is also a terrible sound that they use in every single horror film, is, like, doors creaking and sound scratching. No, I think it was just, like, a culmination of the things that just scared the living shit out of me.
And, you know, again, just now there's the anticipation of scares, right? So when we first meet Rebecca, the fact that she's in the shower and the kind of things are foggy and you're like, wait, is something going to happen? And again, because we've been conditioned that way, you think so, but nothing does. So.
No.
All righty. Thank you guys for joining us. I don't think we need to talk much more than this. It was a short movie.
It was scary.
A great movie, but we don't need to beat it over the death. And that's why it was great to have Alex here to talk about it with us. Let us know what you guys thought of the movie, what portions were the scariest for you, and, you know, what'd you think of Alex's character, Brett? I thought he was fantastic.
I thought he was awesome.
So
it's like, you know what? He's a good boyfriend.
He is indeed. All right, guys. Thank you guys for joining us at the Popcorn Talk and at Movie Anatomy. You can follow us there and check back every single week. We have, listen, in our archives, we've done a lot of movies, so you can check out all the movies we've done. And as you see them, watch The Anatomy. And as future movies come out, we'll be doing them. We'll be doing Star Trek Beyond soon. We're going to be doing Jason Bourne, War Dogs, Sausage Party, so on and so forth. And Sharknado 4. I know that's a TV movie, but we're going to be doing that Monday very soon, so
but we've also covered Annabelle, Conjuring 2, and Insidious,
absolutely.
You got the horror covered as well,
so definitely check those out if you love horror, and if you are excited for Sharknado, check out our Popcorn Talks interview with Tara Reid in anticipation of the fourth movie. I've been lucky enough to see the fourth movie. It is fantastic. At Serafini TV says bye. Yes.
Bye.
And I do too, so we'll see you guys next time on another Anatomy of a Movie. Enjoy the creepy music.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff, we would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.